All right, take two. Here we go. Did everybody get a source sheet? All right, so the story of Vashti has always bothered me. I grew up going to a non-religious elementary school where we did not learn Midrashim at all. So Vashti was presented to us as this, like, feminist champion of women's rights who, you know, stood up for herself and met her bitter end, right? And then when you enter the religious world and you send your kid to preschool and they come home and they're like, Vashti was terrible. She made the Jewish women into slaves and made them work on Shabbat. And then Hashem gave her pimples and a tail, which, by the way, the Midrash doesn't say that anywhere. It says pimples or a tail, but fine. And that's why she didn't go to Ahasuerus, right? So then when my kids were little, I remember always being like, I had heard that before, but I was just kind of like, why is this like the way we view Vashti? Like, she's just bad. But when you read the pshat of the Megillah, she doesn't seem so bad, right? It's hard to tell what's really going on. If you look in Perek Aleph on page 1252, we basically just have three psukim where we meet her, right? So in Pasuk 9, Tet, it says, Gam Vashti Hamalka asa mishten nashim, beit hamalchut, asher lemelech Achashverosh, right? Vashti also made a feast for the women in the palace, in the royal house, which was for Melech Achashverosh, like meaning the house of King Achashverosh. Bayom hachvi'i ketzob lev hamelech bayayin amar lim human bisa harvona bigta bagta. So on the seventh day, he's nice and drunk, and he tells his seven servants to bring Vashti the queen before the king in her crown, to show off her beauty to all of the nations and the ministers who are there, because she is beautiful. Okay, so she refuses to come. The queen Vashti refuses to come, according to the word of the king that came in the hands of the Sarisim, which is probably translated, what do they say here? I've seen a few different ones. Chamberlains? Okay, fine. It probably means people who are castrated, who were used to deal with the women, so that there was no concern about them being inappropriate with the female, like concubines and queen and stuff. Right? And the king was very angry and his anger burned within him. Okay? So that's really all we see about her. And then what goes on to happen, they decide she should never see the king again, right? And then they tell him that he should send out this edict telling everyone all over his kingdom that women need to listen to their husbands and women need to speak the language of their husbands, and that's sort of how it ends. So what goes on with that sort of edict, we're not going to deal with today, and why that was necessarily the conclusion that they drew from this episode is obviously leaves some questions. Some people say that it was sort of that Hashem kind of planted this idea, or maybe even Haman planted this idea, to make Achashverosh into a little bit more of a laughingstock, which ultimately served to help, because when the next decree came about killing the Jews, people didn't necessarily take it as seriously as they would have, because the last time they got a decree, it was like the weirdest thing ever. Like, everyone should listen to their husband. Well, like, we're talking about ancient times. They probably did that already. So why was that a decree from the king? But we're not going to really go into that today. What I want to deal with is who was Vashti and what was her character. So if you look at the first source I gave you, this is from the Mishnah and Megillah, and it's discussing, where do you need to read the Megillah from in order to fulfill your obligation on Purim to hear the Megillah, right? And we all know you need to hear every single word. That's ultimately the halacha that we determine. But there are opinions in the Mishnah that say maybe you can start from the beginning of Perek Bet, the second chapter, where it starts to introduce us to Mordechai. Another opinion that says even after that, we only have to start in chapter 3. So there's these different opinions. So what's the root of this question? What are these rabbis really saying? Like, what's the point of the first two prakim, right? Why do we need them? Are they really necessary to the story? And ultimately, we decide that they are. But the question is, why? Why do we need to hear this story of Vashti? What would have happened if they would have just said in like two lines, the king had this queen, she didn't listen to him, he got rid of her, he needed a new one, and Esther was chosen? Like, why do we need this whole elaborate sort of detailing of the whole situation with getting rid of Vashti and the party and the details of the party and then the details of the women going to the special place where they, you know, bathe themselves and beautify themselves and get ready to see the king? Like, why is all that detail necessary? So there's a lot to be said about that, and it's probably trying to give us a little bit of a picture of like the lifestyle that existed in Persia and what kind of values they had. But really the question is, why do we need to even know about Vashti altogether? So I think that
There's basically two trains of thought, which I already sort of shared, right? There's what I learned as a kid, that Vashti was this like feminist champion. And then there's the perspective that she was this evil, terrible queen, and which then begs the question, which the Gemara does ask, which we'll see in a minute. If she was such a terrible person and she had such bad morality and she also was like a promiscuous person, then like, why didn't she want to come show off her beauty? Why did she say no? And really, you can see both trains of thought in Chazal, but definitely the dominant one is the more negative view of Vashti, more as a villain. And if you look at source, so before we go to that, I think the biggest question you would have about Vashti based on her character is, why would she say no? If she is a political victim, right? And she's just sort of out of luck, Ahasuerus made this decision, he's drunk, he did whatever silly decision he made. Why does she choose to say no? Assuming we read the story the way Chazal do, which that it wasn't just that he asked her to come in her crown, but they asked her to come in only her crown, that she was supposed to come in the nude. Why would she say no? What gave her this idea that she should basically put herself, you know, on the chopping block by saying no? She must have realized that there was an opportunity for him to punish her. So why did she go with it, right? And then on the other hand, if she's a bad person, why did she say no? If she was this promiscuous person, we'll see in a minute, the Gemara talks about how she had her party in the same palace because she wanted to create this sort of like sexual orgy situation where the king wanted to be with her women and she wanted to be with his men. And so they had parties right next door. So there could be a little bit of like, you know, sexual situations going on. So if that's the case, then why would she say no? So either way, you have to question, why would someone who's the queen, who's in control, who has, you know, whatever she needs, her husband is the king of like the entire empire, what's compelling her to say no to him? So if you look at the more modern, let's call it pshat-based, heroic view of Vashti, then you have to assume that it's because she was standing by her principles and she was willing to lose the king-queenship or die for them. If you look at the more classical midrashic approach where she's the villain, then there has to be some other reason why she's sort of taking this stand, right? But what I want to do is first look at the way that Chazal view her, the more classical approach, the negative approach, examine that a little bit, and then move on to the more positive approach. So if you look in source number two, this is the Gemara in Megillah. It's basically all on Daf Yud Bet. I like cut some parts out just to make it easier for us to follow. I gave you the English there. The English, the bold is the actual translation and the non-bolded text is like the commentary slash explanation. I'm going to read it quickly in the Hebrew slash Aramaic and go through it. But if you'd like to follow in the English, you're welcome to. Okay. Gam Vashti Hamalka Samishten Nashim Beit Hamalchut. So this is commenting on the verse where it says the Vashti also made a party. Beit Hanashim Mi Baile. It should have said in the house of the women, right? Why did she make the party in Beit HaMalchut Asher LeMelech HaChashverosh, in the house of the king that is Achashverosh's house? She must have had her own quarters. Why didn't she make the party in her area of the palace? Why would she make it in Achashverosh's area of the palace? Amar Rabba, Shnehen Lidvar Aveira Nitkavnu. They both intended for sinful actions. B'yomashvi'i Ketov Lev HaMelech B'yayin. Now it's commenting on the verse of when on the seventh day that the king was good and drunk and he's going to call her over. Atu ad hashto lo tav libei b'chamra. Wasn't he drunk already? Like, what does it mean he only got drunk on the seventh day? Like, he's been drinking for how many days? Like, what do you mean he only on the seventh day? Amar Rava. What does Rava say? Yom hashvi Shabbat haya. The seventh day was Shabbat. She Yisrael ochlim v'shotzin, mechlim b'divrei Torah v'divrei tishbachot. What do the Jewish people do on the seventh day? They sit and they eat and they drink and they start to skiv over divrei Torah and to praise God. About umat ha'olam she'ochlim v'shotzin, but the nations of the world who are eating and drinking, ein mechlim ela b'divrei tiflut. They only begin to deal with issues of like sort of, how do you translate tiflut? Nothingness. Hevel is also Hebrew. I'm Israeli already. I can't think of English words. sort of like things that are not appropriate, things that are worthless. V'chem esuda toshel oto rasha, and so too in this seuda, this fancy feast of the king. Halalu amrim. These were saying, what are they talking about on the seventh day? Madiot na'ot. The women from Madai are the most beautiful. Halalu amrim. And the other people were saying that Parsiot na'ot. The women from Persia are the most beautiful. Amar lehem Achashverosh. Achashverosh says to them, Klisha animish temeshbo, the tool that I use, or the vessel that I use, meaning my queen, Vashti, that's how he's speaking about her. Eino lom midai velom parsi, ela kasti. She's not from Madai and she's not from Paras, she's from Kastim. Rotzonchem lirotah, do you guys want to see her? Right? So what's this presenting him as?
totally no dignity, treating her like an absolute object, right? It's painting this picture. And it does seem that way from the pshat, that that's what's going on, that he's treating her as an object. But it's painting it in the picture as, well, the Jewish people should be sitting down to sing Zmiros and eat Shabbos meals and give Divrei Torah. These people are sitting down and comparing the beauty and sexiness of the women from different countries. And he's trying to get in on the action by bringing his wife to the table and showing how much greater she is. Amru lo, in. They said yes, but only if she's naked. And in a way that a person measures, that's how he will be measured. This teaches us, this teaches us that Vashti, the evil woman, would bring Jewish girls and strip them naked, and she would force them to do work on Shabbat. As it says, after these things, this is again a quote from the Megillah, when the anger of the king abated, when the anger of the king Achashverosh abated, Zacharat Vashti, he remembered Vashti, the Etzes Shera Sata, and what she did, the Etzes Shera Nigzar Aleha, and what was decreed upon her. Kishem Shera Sata, Kach Nigzar Aleha. As she did, this is what was decreed upon her. Meaning they're learning from the language of the Pasuk that it must be that what happened to her was in direct response to her own actions, that it was Mida Keneged Mida, that it was because of the way she behaved, she was punished in that regard. Okay, but Tamen Hamalka Vashti, and Vashti the queen refuses to come, Michtei Pritzta Havai. But wasn't she a pritza? Wasn't she a promiscuous woman? To Amar Mar says, Shnehen Litvar Berenit Kavu, as we heard before, right? They both had inappropriate intention. So, like, why didn't she want to come? My Tama Loatai, why didn't she come? Amar Rabbi Yossi Bar Chanina. Rabbi Yossi Bar Chanina says, Melemetche Parcha Bat Tzara'at. It teaches us that she suddenly erupted with Tzara'at, which is maybe leprosy, probably not, but some sort of skin condition where she was embarrassed to show herself. B'matznita Tana, and it also there's a brayta that says Ba Gavriel Basala Zanav, and Gavriel came and gave her a tail. Okay, so we have two options. Why didn't she come? According to the opinion that she's a promiscuous evil woman, she's not coming because she thinks it's the wrong thing to do. She's not coming because she's embarrassed and she doesn't want to show her face in public because either she's got a tail or she's got tzara'at. B'yiksof haMelech Ma'od, and the king became very angry. Amai Delaka BeKulahai, so. Why did he sort of respond in such a intense way? Like, why didn't he just say, oh, okay, she's not coming. Sorry, guys. Like, why did it create such a response? Amar Rava. Rava said, Shalchale, she sent him a message. Bar Ahuria, I tried to read this before and couldn't do it. Ahurayai Rei, Da'aba, you are the stable man of my father. Okay, we're going to talk about this in a second. Abba lekabel alfa chamrash David vilaraz Rave. My father could sit opposite 1,000 men and drink and not get drunk. Hahu Gavra, and you, meaning that guy, but she's referring to you, Ishtate Chamreya, you're drunk. The Miyad, and he said immediately, V'chamato ba'arabo, and immediately he became angered with her. So this Gemara is telling us a lot. First of all, it's telling us that, and we're going to see sources in a second that confirm it, that Vashti's father was in some way very important, and Achashverosh started off his life working for him, right? Which means that if he married Vashti, the implication is his power and his control are only coming as a result of her, right? He married into it. And that she's insulting him. She's saying, like, you don't have what it takes to be this person. Who is this person? We'll talk about in a second. My father could handle his wine. You can't handle your wine. She's comparing him. And for someone who clearly needs to show off his power and his wealth and his prestige and is sort of obsessed with it, calling him out and saying how he doesn't measure up to others is going to really incense him, which is ultimately what the Gemara is saying happened. Okay, so that's the traditional Midrashic perspective on who Vashti was. So she's not very nice. She enslaves the Jewish girls and forces them to work naked on Shabbat. She doesn't seem to have much morality of her own. She's got this promiscuous nature. She decides to have the party in the king's palace, Dafka, so that she can create sexual orgy type situations. And that's sort of where the Gemara kind of leaves us off. And we also get this information that Achashverosh started off not coming from royalty. Okay, so in source number 3, you see Rashi. He actually quotes the same idea about her getting tzara'at or leprosy, and that's why she didn't want to come. And he is clearly quoting from that Gemara. So that's where our kids are learning this idea. Most of my girls don't learn the naked part. They just learn the part about working on Shabbat. But that's where they're getting this from. They're getting it from Rashi, who got it straight out of the Gemara. And if you look at source number 4,
This is another Gemara. It says, Vashti Harasha, bat beno shel Nebuchadnezzar Harasha. She's the granddaughter of Nebuchadnezzar. Who's Nebuchadnezzar?
Babylonian king.
He's the Babylonian king who destroyed the temple and exiled the Jewish people. His son is Belshazzar, and she is supposedly Belshazzar's daughter, okay? So the Midrashim talk about this, that Achashverosh, sort of his father, and Achashverosh conquered the Babylonian, the Persians conquering the Babylonians, and then they choose Vashti as his queen, so to sort of give some legitimacy to the fact that he's the king now, it sort of lends itself, like, of course he's royalty, he's married to Vashti, right? So it just gives itself its legitimacy. And we'll see in the Malbim in a little bit, but what does that imply? Meaning, if you're Persia and you just conquered Babylonia, on the one hand, you want that legitimacy and you want to marry someone royal. On the other hand, you don't want anyone to be questioning your legitimacy as the emperor and your legitimacy of your power. So on the one hand, you need her. And on the other hand, she's a bit of a political liability, right? Because now people are going to say, well, you're only the king because of her, right? So the way that some of the Mefarshim understand it is, why does he call her to the party? Is it to show her off, or is it to demean her? Is it to show that she is so beautiful and special, or is it to show that she's just beautiful and special, and he only married her because she's beautiful, not because she was the next in line for the throne of Babel, okay? So those are sort of two ways you could look at it. Okay, if you look at... Oh, okay, sorry, we just read source 4, right? We did source 4?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, sorry. So also when Chazal associate her with Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar is like, you know, he's like the, I guess he's like Haman. Like he's like the prototypical evil man. Like the way that he's always depicted in Chazal, the way that he's depicted, he's this ruthless, terrible, evil emperor, right? So if by associating her with him, they're automatically giving a judgment on her character. Even without going into all the Gemaras where they start talking about like how she behaved and what she did to the Jewish girls, the reason they think she's like that and they assume she's like that and they question why she wouldn't come in the first place is because Babylonian culture was known for being very promiscuous and having no morality, no ethics. And so that is, and again, we're talking about the Talmud Bavli. We're talking about the rabbis who were in the Gemara were living in that culture and seeing it around them. And so their judgment, I actually read a piece by someone that, and then I heard a shir quoting it and it was like, it doesn't make any sense, but it was a very interesting idea. She was saying that if you look at the Midrashim that come from Eretz Yisrael and you look at the Midrashim that come out of Bavel, the negativity towards Vashti is more so coming from like Talmud Bavli and Babylonian Midrashim because their association with Babylonian people was so negative, whereas the people in the land of Israel don't have that same negative association, and so their Midrashim tend to take more of the political victim approach as opposed to the evil empress approach. That's sort of true. Like in Midrash Rabbah, you do see Vashti as more of the political victim, but then you also see Midrashim about her being an evil person. So that's why it like doesn't really work out. But there's definitely both ideas in the Midrash. Like Chazal definitely took both perspectives. They took the perspective that perhaps she was this evil, terrible woman, and they also take the perspective that she's a victim of circumstance. She's this political victim. Achashverosh forces her to marry him. She never really wants to be there. She thinks her father's way better than him. She thinks the Persians are like, you know, nouveau riche, and like she has no interest in being a part of this. And then look at him. He's making a fool of himself. He has no dignity. He's drinking until he can't even think straight. And like, what, you know, a busha to the, yeah, like, and so she is saying, like, I'm not coming to show up for you. I don't care if you're going to kill me. Like, this is, like, I don't want to be a part of this. And why is he doing it? Because he is trying to insult her and demean her so that he can show that ultimately his power has nothing to do with her. It's his own power. He runs the world now. So those are sort of two perspectives. If you look at source number 5, this is Esther Rabbah, and this is where we see the political sort of victim approach. So, Tim'ena Malka Vashti. So, Vashti refuses to come. So, if you look at the fourth last word on the first line, I'm going to start from there. Amra lo, she said to him, Imro inoti na'a, hen not nina nehem lishta meshbi vehor gimotcha. If they think I'm beautiful, they're going to want to use me and they're going to kill you. The Imro inoti krua, and if they see ka'ura, if they see me as unattractive, at mit gonna be, you're going to be unattracted to me now. It's kind of a lose-lose. Either they're going to think I'm beautiful and they're going to be like, great, let's all kill Achashverosh so we can rape Vashti. And if they don't think she's beautiful, they're going to tell you I'm not beautiful and then you're going to be done with me and then I'm what's going to happen to me. So that's sort of how she's trying to convince him to revoke the decree that she should come. So she tries to hint to him, and he doesn't understand. So then she sends another message. Now we're on the sort of the middle of line three. Shalcha ve'amra lo. She sends him a message. Komis istablati shel beit abba hayita. You were the stable boy in my father's house. V'hayita lamud lehiyot machnis lefenecha nashim zonot arumot. You used to bring prostitutes in for you. And even now that you've become the king, you haven't abandoned your corruption. You're still just as trashy and low class as you were back then. And again, the Midrash goes on and says, like, he still didn't understand. He still wanted her to come. And then she tries telling him that, like, you can't have a queen come naked. And she's basically pleading for her life. She's basically, the way the Midrash shows her here, she's trying to reason with him. This is a bad idea. Don't make me do this. It's not going to end well for either one of us. And she's trying to uphold his dignity. So I want to just sort of discuss the Midrashic point for a couple minutes before we move on to the other perspective. So a couple things. First of all, I came across a few really interesting sort of thoughts on the Midrash about the tails and the tzara'at. So the tzara'at, if you look, I actually think I gave you the source for this. Did I? Maybe not. No, maybe not. Okay. The story of Uzziahu, the King Uzziahu. He is a very successful king. He becomes sort of very sure of himself, and he decides he wants to be Kohen Gadol also, and he basically storms into Beit Mikdash and tries to bring the incense offering, right? And he ends up getting stricken with tzara'at, and then it says that he was basically stuck in the palace for the rest of his days. He couldn't go to Beit Hashem, and it says nigzar mi Beit Hashem, that he was sort of decreed from the house of God. It's a very weird phraseology, but it's the same phraseology that's used here, where it talks about how Ahasuerus woke up, remembered Vashti, regretted what he did, and it says asher nigzar aleha, that what was decreed upon her, he remembers the decree that happened to her. And so some Mefarshim say that maybe the Midrash is recognizing that same language that happened, of what happened to Uzziahu. He actually did the opposite of Vashti. He entered the king's chamber when he wasn't supposed to, the king being God, right, when he sort of stormed the Beit Mikdash and tried to do something he wasn't meant to do, whereas Esther refused to come to the king's chamber when she was called. Vashti, thank you. Vashti refused to enter the king's chamber in which she was called. And so we have this sort of like juxtaposition of the two of them, but both of them have this word nigzar associated with them. And perhaps that's where Chazal got this idea about tzara'at, that Uzziahu got tzara'at, and maybe that's why they think Vashti got tzara'at. Another interesting thing that I came across was sort of this idea of what does the tail represent, right? So what do you think of when you think of a tail? Animalistic, right? If we're going to go with Chazal's reading of her as this promiscuous, terrible, evil woman who has no sense of human dignity for anyone else and just wants to, you know, create like total chaos in the party and just have sex with whoever she can find and whatever, that's kind of how Chazal is spelling it out, then she's an animalistic person. She's sort of lost her human neshama. She's lost her ability to connect to her human dignity. And so she's being represented as having a tail. Now, this obviously, and we're not going to go into this now, begs the question of like, how do you read Midrash and how do we teach Midrash to our children? Because the danger in teaching our five-year-olds that Vashti grew a tail is that by the time they turn 12, they're going to be like, get real. Like, she really grew a tail? Like, I know God can do whatever he wants, but like, okay, other than splitting the sea, like, when did he last just, like, completely change nature? And, like, it just doesn't fit. Like, there have been so many times in history where God could have and should have intervened and done something crazy miraculous to make a point and didn't. So why here? Like, it just is so crazy. But if you can understand Midrashim as being figurative and that Chazal are trying to teach a lesson, what are they trying to say? Something happened to Vashti. Either she got tzara'at or she got a tail. Something happened to her. God struck her with some sort of ailment to make her feel embarrassed so that she wouldn't go, even though she herself had the nature that she would have loved to go and parade herself around naked with her crown on. God made it so that she wouldn't be able to go, so that he could orchestrate everything to happen the way it happened, to get Esther into the palace so she could be there, right?
I read something very fascinating once. I don't remember where, I don't remember the source for it, yeah. But what does a tail represent?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, basically she had got a stomach virus.
Oh, interesting.
Like a stomach virus.
Oh, stomach.
Yeah, right.
Put it nicely.
Right. I read something else where they equated it to like
a queen, like a tail.
Right.
And that's why she couldn't go, because
yeah, and it's like she was feeling self-conscious. Whatever it was, Hashem did something to her to make her not be able to go at the last second, in order to orchestrate the events the way they needed to be orchestrated. But that doesn't mean Chazal really believes she grew a tail. It means they're trying to say something about her nature, or they're trying to say something. It doesn't mean she grew a tail, right? So it's just important for us to realize, like,
That doesn't mean your kids, like, you should ridicule them when they come home in kindergarten with, like, their little puppets and there's the tail and the dots on the face and whatever, right? Like, whatever. But it's important for us to recognize that Midrash is not, it's not immature and, like, silliness. It's actually very deep, figurative language, and they spoke differently in those days. They taught with a lot of analogy and a lot of metaphor, and that's how they explained things, and that's how people understood things. But we're not supposed to just read it at face value and be like, oh, yeah, Vashti had a tail, sure. Like, that's not what's going on. So I just thought both of those were sort of interesting, but at the end of the day, the message, either way, whether it was Tzaraat or it was a tail, is that God somehow intervened, that even though it wouldn't have been her nature to say no, Hashem set it up so that she would, okay? So that's sort of that first perspective. And if you think about Vashti in this perspective, she is the perfect foil to Esther. And I was just thinking about this morning. I was speaking to my husband and I was saying how I hated English class. My husband is not into Tanakh so much. Like, he just doesn't get, like, why I love Tanakh. And I was saying, like, I just love, like, I was reading this article and it was the literary, like, understanding of how Vashti helps us understand Esther and Vashti helps us understand Mordechai, which we'll get to in a minute. And, like, it's just so fascinating how you can draw from the linguistic parallels. And my husband was like, we went to high school together. You hated English class. Like, why do you find this interesting? And, like, it's totally different for me. Like, if you give me, like, a proper, like, novel and want me to, like, analyze it and talk about the themes and the whatever, I'm like, get me out of here. But when you get me into Tanakh, I'm like all over it, right? But here, if you think about it, even if this really who Vashti was, why is she in the Megillah? Why did we decide that we needed to read this parak? It's to help us understand how very different Esther is, right? Yes, they're both queens. They're even both orphans, assuming that Belshazzar was killed. She's also an orphan. They both throw parties, right? They're both the only ones who really go against the king's will, right? When Vashti refuses to come and when Esther enters the palace without being invited, those are going against his rules and they're the only ones to do that. So it's just, there's all these similarities, but then they're just so different in so many ways. And you see how Vashti is sort of, I mean, the way the Midrash paints her, right? She's a little obnoxious. She says all these very rude comments to her husband about how he's just a stable boy. He can't hold his wine, right? And Esther is like, if it's okay with you, if you don't mind, could you maybe, you and Haman, would you like to maybe come to my party tomorrow night? Right? Like, it's very, like, she's so timid and careful and kind of presents herself as very meek because she knows that's how she's going to win the king over. He needs to feel like he's in control. And so she, you can almost see that, like, Esther learned from Vashti what she needed to do in order to succeed. And she sort of tries to be the anti-Vashti. Like, Vashti's the anti-Esther, but Esther learns from everything Vashti did and tries to behave in the opposite way in order to be successful. So I think maybe that's why we need to read about Vashti so that we can better understand Esther. If you think about the more positive view, which we've seen a little bit already, but there's... Oh, sorry. I totally forgot another point I wanted to make. So let's just look at source 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11. We're not going to read them inside. I'm just going to talk about what they are. I listened to a shiur the other day. I was driving, and it was super technical and intense, and I had to go back and listen to it again yesterday, which was so annoying. But it was fascinating. From Rabbi Mordechai Turchiner, who was the Rosh Kollel of the YU Kollel in Toronto, where my husband used to learn. And he made a very interesting suggestion. So there's this midrash in source number 6. It says, Arba Nashim Natlu Mamshela Meolam. There were four women who sort of took the reins of power in the world. The Elan, Izebel, the Talia Misrael, the Shimramit, the Vashti, Meumatolam. Okay? So we don't know so much about Semiramit. We do know a lot about Izebel and Atalia. Who are Izebel and Atalia? Right? So look at source number 7. Who's Izebel? She's Ahab's wife. And she's basically the reason he did everything bad. She's like the brains behind the operation. She's sort of the force. She seems to be running. He's a bad king and she's the one who makes him bad, according to this pasuk, right? She was, and in the next pasuk, in source number 8, at the very end, it says that, Yehu comes and they are going to come and speak to, they want to sort of check out the shalom, give respect to the king, uvnei ha-gvira, and the sons of, it says here, queen mother, I think this is a terrible translation, what's a gvir or a gibor? Strong. Strong one, right? Usually we refer to men as like the gibor, but here she's referred to as the gvira. She's the strong one. She's the one with the power. Izebel is being depicted as this woman who isn't just married to the king, but she has power and strength in and of her own right. And who is she? She is the daughter of the king of the Tzidonim, okay? Izebel and Ahab have a daughter. Her name is Atalia.
Atalia also takes on strength and sort of wields her own power. In source number 9, there's a story where Ahaziah is dead, and so she kills off all the other heirs to the throne. It turns out that she misses one and whatever, but she decides that she's gonna take this into her own hands. If her son's dead, no one else gets to be king. And she wields this power, and she, again, comes from kingship herself because she is the son of Izebel and Ahab, and she wields her own power. And these midrashim are all pointing to what Rabbi Mordechai Tertiner points to as what he calls a biblical archetype of women who are the sons of a king in their own right, who are then married to another king, but have their own strength and their own power. And he suggests that maybe that's how they tied Vashti into this. It makes sense according to Chazal's reading of the historical situation, and it makes sense in terms of how Chazal understand the whole setup with Vashti and the reason why she would make the party there and all of those things. It makes a lot of sense, but it also fits in with this sort of biblical archetype. If she is the daughter of a king, then she has power in and of herself, and she has that ability and that strength. So he sort of points to this. He gives the other example, which isn't mentioned in this midrash, but the story with Michal, right? Michal is the daughter of Shaul. David is dancing with the Mishkan, and she's all like with the Aron, and she's like all embarrassed, like, how could you act that way? Like, that's so not, you know, dignified for a king. And he's kind of like, well, listen, like, Hashem chose me and not your dad, so obviously, like, I'm in the right and you're in the wrong. But they have this sort of power struggle between them, and she's expressing that she knows what she's talking about because she comes from kingship herself. Right? And again, this other example where Shlomo spends 13 years, source 11, building a palace, and then he builds another one just like it for his wife, the daughter of Paro. Somehow she seems to have convinced him that, like, she needs this whole fancy palace. It's obviously fancy, but it took 13 years to build. And I didn't give the whole pasuk here to save space, but like, it's like goes on and on about the details of what the palace looked like. And then he builds one as well for her. That doesn't necessarily sound like normal practice, because if it was, it wouldn't have been mentioned in the pasuk. But it goes out of its way to mention that he's married to the daughter of Paro. So again, there's a woman who somehow seems to have some power either over her husband or over the world in general, or who feels that she has, knows what she's doing and is willing to, like, even murder people because of her lineage. So I thought it was really interesting. I'm not totally convinced by this, because I don't feel like there's enough examples of this to be like, and Vashti fits this, because it's sort of like Chazal decided Vashti was the daughter of Belshazzar and then said that she fit this. So then you're saying, this is how you're going to tell me that you know that she's the daughter of Belshazzar? But she does assert herself when she refuses to come. So that maybe there is some value to that. So I just wanted to bring that, because I just thought it was sort of an interesting approach where you recognize, right? She refers to the queen regularly. She's asked to come in her crown. So a lot of the Mefarshim understand that means her crown, not his crown, her crown, because she was the queen of Babel, well, the princess of Babel before. When it talks in the very beginning of the Megillah, it says Vihibi Me'Achashverosh, right? It's in the days of Achashverosh, Hamolech Nehodu Ve'ad Kush. Right? What does hamolech mean? It's a very, very strange use of the verb. So Rabbi Tertiner argues that one of the ways you can parse that verb is that he began to reign. And that's sort of proof to Chazal's theory that he was a new emperor who kind of came into this and didn't start off that way. So there's sort of a lot, sort of all these different things. If you look at the Malbim now, we're going to move now to more of the favorable approach to Vashti. If you look at the Malbim, the Malbim on Esther is absolutely fascinating. All of these Mefarshim, I'm sorry I couldn't give them to you in English. I just didn't have the time to write translations and couldn't track them down. But we'll go through them. But the Malbim on Esther, if you have time, you can get it in English. It is absolutely fascinating. He has a whole political explanation of all the moving parts and how everything is happening and why it's all happening and what's motivating every person. And it's really, really brilliant. So he says the following about Vashti. Okay. So he says, B'yom HaShvi'i, on the seventh day of the party, V'lema'an yaniach zot liyasod musad ve'even harosha shevashti ein lachalek b'malchut. Why is he going to do this? Why is he calling her? Because he wants to make a clear establishment that she doesn't have a part in the kingship. U'malchutohi mitzad hakivush levad. His kingship is because of his conquest alone. She'al yadei zeh yasig megamato lihiyot molech mimamlecha bilti mugvelet. He has in this introduction this whole definition of, like, some kings have, like, a boundless kingship and some have bounded kingship, and we're not going to go into that. He was very smart that he commanded Vashti to come, to show that he didn't marry her because of her yichus, because of where she came from, rak mitzad shiyafat marehi, only because she is beautiful. Lo zulat zeh, ki yichus malchuta nifsak be'et hakibush, and not just this, but also that her lineage stopped when he conquered them. Like, she no longer has any sort of claim to fame. It's over. Well, I'm the new guy in town. So what if you were the princess before? Look what happened to your kingdom. It crashed and burned. So who cares, right? You're only here because you're good looking. You're not here for any other reason. Okay. Then, next line. The seven eunuchs. Okay. She'im haita nechshevet kemolechet bifnei atzma. If she was thought of as a queen in and of herself, Eich Yoviluha al Yadei Hasarisim, how could he go and call her with Sarisim? These are a low level of servants. If somebody wants to go get the king to let him know someone's here to see him, who are you going to send to tell him? Not just some guy, not some butler. You're going to send like one of his top advisors to let him know, right? If you're calling the queen, you're not going to send some servant. You're going to send important people. Hello, Ruishi Yatuli Kretak, Kol Sareha Melucha. Shouldn't the ministers be the ones to come and get her? If he's sending her the sarisim almost as an insult, he's trying to say to her, like, you're nothing. You think you're the queen? You're not the queen. You're just married to me. You don't even deserve the dignity of like proper dignitaries coming to get you. I'm just sending you some sarisim. You better get over here and show yourself off. And she's like, no, right? Okay. Shigam lo bachar shetav. We're in bet now. Shigam lo bachar shetav al yedei hasarisim hamesher tim. So rak al yedei hasarisim hamesher tim et pnei hamelech achashverosh. She wants the people who are serving the king. She says shiflu gadol lefaneha. This is very demeaning for her. Shemach shiva echad mipilag shav. He's treating her just like one of the concubines. Asher sarisav yavohu lefana. That's who usually the sarisim are in charge. It's the concubine. She's supposed to be different. She's the queen. But he's trying to show her, no, you're just some other woman. You're not important. You're not special. So that's the Malbim's read. Ibn Ezra also takes a more favorable approach. So again, like, even though I always, you know, you always read it as like the modern, like if you look at any modern scholarship on Megillat Esther, it's all very pro-Vashti. Why? Because they're not looking at Midrashim. They're not interested in Midrashim. They're looking at the text itself and maybe trying to understand the culture of the time. But they're seeing this ancient queen who was willing to stand up to her husband. Like, whoa, that's awesome. First feminist ever. So cool, right? So that's how they read it. But you see that even in the earlier Mefarshim, there are those who don't necessarily view her as a villain. So what does Ibn Ezra say? Basically, it was a miscalculation. He says what I underline here, Or cheshvesh hu shikor. She said no because, like, she thought he was drunk. Maybe this happens all the time. Maybe he gets drunk and says stupid stuff all the time. And she just knows that if she just kind of like, okay, whatever, like later on, he'll move on and he'll get over it. She didn't expect his response to be so intense and to ultimately either cost her life or have her just sent to the harem and never to see him again. Those are the two opinions about what happened to her. Because it never says in the text that she was killed. It just says that she'll never see him again. So it's not clear what happened to her. But that's neither here nor there. Okay, so maybe it was just a miscalculation. The Ralbag, he has two different comments that sort of say two different things, but both of them kind of paint her as more favorable. So if you look at source number 14, three lines down, Ve'efshar, does everybody see where we are? Okay, Ve'efshar shiheh ratzon bezeh, ki hu lo ratzta levo bidvar hamelech, mipnei hiyoto biyad hasarisim, ki lega'uta hayta rotza, shiishlach la'achashverosh sarim rabim nechbadim me'ela. So he says the same thing as the Malbim. She didn't want to come because she didn't like that he sent sarisim. She wanted some fancier ministers to come and get her. And the fact that he sent the sarisim was offensive. And so she wasn't going to come. You're going to offend me? I'm not coming, right? But then what does he say in the next parak? So the next parak is when Achashverosh wakes up and regrets his decision. So Zacharit Vashti Vetasher Asta Vetasher Nigzar Aleah. So Achashverosh remembers what she did and what was decreed upon her. Yitba Er Mehanim Shach Mizeh Shehu Zacharit Vashti Biofya. He remembered Vashti and her beauty. Vahayad Doeg, and he was concerned. Al Shenehrga Ki Asher Asta Lo Haya Ba'ofen Shehiya Ra'ui Ligzor Aleah. Because he realized that the way that what happened to her wasn't right. It wasn't fitting for what was decreed upon her. She was just acting out of modesty, right? Most people, even in those days, probably didn't think it was normal for the queen to be paraded naked in front of common people. Like, that's a little bizarre, right? She's his private property. She's just for the king. And so she didn't come because she thought it was improper. And so that's why she didn't come. And he wakes up either the next day or however long later, and he's like, wow, I guess that was probably a really ridiculous request that I made of her. And now I've killed her. At least according to the Ralbach, she's dead. And, like, there's nothing I can do about it. I really messed up here. Like, he regrets it. He's feeling regret because he recognizes now that she was in the right. There's a bunch of articles on the Virtual Beit Midrash website, but it's also been turned into a book now by Rabbi Yoni Grossman. I forget what the book is called. But his thesis is all about how Yosef is a very, very clear motif throughout the Megillah. There are so many textual references. Yifat Tohar and Yifat Mar'eh, right? How beautiful. That's how Yosef is referred to. Only Yosef and Rachel are referred to that way. And then we see it again with Esther. But what's the very first reference that we see to the Yosef story in the Megillah? It's Vatima'en. Right? When Yosef is cornered by Eshet Potiphar, Potiphar's wife, and she tries to seduce him, and he, right, and we read it in Shul, like, na, 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 with the shel shelet, because she's like, it's like, we say it's because he was like grappling with it, but ultimately he refuses her. And then we see the same exact verb here, that Vashti refuses the king. When he calls her to come, she refuses to come. So that Rabbi Grossman actually suggests that maybe she was really standing on her principles, just like Yosef, even if he might have been sexually interested in Eshet Potiphar, knew it was the wrong thing to do. And so he stood on his principles and he said no. Vashti here knows this is the wrong thing to do, and she stood on her principles and she said no. And he doesn't, I didn't see this. I read the English, maybe in the Hebrew it's there, but it was reminiscent to me of also of Esther, where she says, Kasher avadati avadati. She says, okay, I'm going to go into the king, and if I die, I die, right? If I'm destroyed, I'll be destroyed. If I'm lost, I'm lost. Meaning, okay, I'm putting myself at risk here, but this is something I have to do, and so I'm going to do it even though it's scary. And Vashti and Yosef, to some extent, do the same thing according to this reading, right? The king could kill me tomorrow. He could decide that, you know, he's excommunicating me or whatever it is that he's going to do because I'm saying no, but I'm not willing to go in there. I'm not willing to make that sort of sacrifice of my dignity. I'd rather die with dignity than go in there and embarrass myself. And same with Yosef. Like, ultimately, what happens when he refuses Eshet Potiphar? He ends up in jail, right? It doesn't end well for him. Ultimately, it ends well. He doesn't know that at the time, but he doesn't care. He's going to stand on his principle, even if it means he's going to end up in jail, or even if it means he's going to get kicked out of the house, or whatever that looks like. So some of the reasons why Chazal might be suspicious with her, right, like we mentioned before, is that she is very comfortable at the party scene. Like, if she wasn't into the kind of lifestyle that Ahasuerus was living, then, like, why'd she make a party also? It doesn't say Ahasuerus made a party for the women with Vashti. It says Vashti made a party. Clearly, she chose to make the party. But on the other hand, we can see here some sort of, like, reflections. There was one of the Mefarshim that I was going to bring, but it was really long, so I decided to cut it out of the source sheet at the last second, but talked about this idea, and now I don't remember who it was, but Rashbam talks about this, Maharikra talks about this. There are a lot of Rishonim who really do view Vashti in a more favorable light, but one of the things they talk about is this idea exactly of her saying, like, okay, I'm willing to die for this, because this is a bad idea no matter which way we slice it. If I come in there, I'm going to lose my dignity, right? And not only is it bad for my dignity, it's bad for your dignity, Ahasuerus. Like, what kind of a king shows off his wife like that? Like, don't you want to be considered, like, on a higher level than all these people? Like, what are you doing? You're crazy, right? And so she sort of has this sense of, like, I can't do this. It's the wrong thing to do. I'm not going to do it. Even if she is painted by Chazal as a more promiscuous woman, that doesn't necessarily mean she wants to parade naked in front of everyone, right? Those are two different things, potentially. And so she decides she's willing to die for that. And what I think is really interesting, and which is what I want to kind of close off with, is this amazing sort of literary reading from Dina Rabinovich. She's a professor at Stern College. She wrote an article a number of years ago in the YU, Torah to Go for Purim, where she sort of points out two really interesting things. So the first thing that she points out is the parallels between Vashti and Mordechai, which I never would have thought of, and I just think it was so fascinating. So she's, if you think about it, there's a couple of things, right? What does Vashti do? She embarrasses the king in the presence of his companions, right? He wants her to come. She refuses to come. He's embarrassed. What does Mordechai do when he doesn't bow down to Haman? He's basically snubbing Haman publicly, right? Everyone else is bowing down, and Mordechai's sitting there like this, like, not happening. That's going to make Haman feel embarrassed, like he's sort of affecting his dignity. And what happens as a result of both of those actions? International edicts are sent out with runners, letting everyone in the entire kingdom know women have to listen to their husbands and the Jews are going to be killed, right? Both of the times that they each embarrass an individual, and that turns into a larger conversation about like new laws in the kingdom. So that's one interesting parallel. Also, the verb baza, which means like to sort of shame, I guess is the best word I could come up with it, comes up with Vashti in Pasuk Yud Zayin 17. It says, where is it? Ki yitzei dvar hamalka al kol anashim, that what the queen did is going to get out to all the women, lehavzot ba'alehen, that they're going to sort of, what does it say here? How did they translate it?
Make their husbands
contemptible. Okay. They're going to, like, treat their husbands badly. They're not going to see their husbands in the same light because they hear, if Vashti can stand up to the king, then I can stand up to my husband, right? So there's this idea that they need to get the message out. Women have to listen to their husbands because they don't want Vashti's message to make it to the wives. So we see it there. And then again, in Perek Gimel, it says, Yeshno, no, sorry, not that one. Pasuk Vav. 6, it says, V'yivez beinav lishloch yad b'Mordechai, right? This idea that it was contemptible to Haman to lay hands on Mordechai alone. He decides he wants to kill all of them. So this idea that this verb v'yivez comes up with both of them, she points to that parallel. And she also points out some plot similarities, right? They both seem, according to this reading, they both seem to be holding up this sort of dignity. Either, if you read it, that Haman was somehow, you know, the Midrash says he had a little idol on his neck and Mordechai wouldn't bow down because then it would be doing a Avodah Zarah, right? So maybe that's what it was. There's actually another read from Yoram Chazoni who says that he had a problem with the fact that Haman became the sole advisor. It used to be the king had this council of men that he, right? Like when Vashti decides to say no, he consults with that council of men, which is another hint that Vashti has some sort of political significance. Because if she was just some woman, it wouldn't even be a question whether or not he should just say off with her head, and that would be it. But he consults with his advisors, because if she's an empress from another nation, you got to make sure this is the right move politically before you just jump on it, right? So that's also another kind of hint to that. But he says, there used to be a council, and now it's just Haman, right? And to Mordechai, that's a sign that there isn't room for thought and there isn't room for consideration. And that is similar to Avodah Zarah, that Haman being the only guy who gets to determine anything that goes on in the kingdom is to Mordechai Avodah Zarah. And that's why he won't bow down to Haman. So I thought that was sort of an interesting perspective. But either way, he's refusing on principle. He may not have realized that him refusing to bow down to Haman meant the whole Jewish people was going to be annihilated. It's possible Mordechai didn't realize that his little stance was going to be so, you know, catastrophic for the Jewish people, but he's standing on principle, just like Vashti, assuming we read it this way, is standing on principle. And we also see, and they're, you know, it's like a lose-lose situation. Either, you know, he bows down to Haman and he compromises his principles, or he doesn't bow down to Haman and he faces death, and ultimately death of all the Jewish people, but he may not have known that. And he makes that decision just like Vashti decides, I'm not going to come in here and parade around naked for you because that's against my principles and I'm willing to die for those principles. So that sort of parallels between them. So in some ways they sort of complement each other. And what Vashti really helps us realize is what happens to a person in Shushan when they don't do what they're supposed to. Right? It's sort of like this tyrannical situation where it just helps highlight for us that later in the story, when we see that Mordechai won't bow down, we kind of have these alarm bells going off like, oh, remember that time Vashti forgot to come? That didn't end well for her. What's going to happen to Mordechai? It sort of helps us realize that Mordechai must have known he was risking something, because this isn't the kind of place where people are like, oh, you don't want to bow down? No problem. You know, like, We're all sensitive to all cultures here, right? Like, that's not the kind of place this was. So clearly Vashti and what happened to her when she stood by her principles is there to sort of remind us or sort of highlight what Mordechai is doing when he stands by his. And then you look at Vashti and Esther, where they're sort of the opposite of each other, right? On the one hand, we talked about all the similarities. They both have parties. They're both queens. Maybe they're both orphans, all these kind of ideas. But then we also have a lot of ways in which they're very different. So Vashti gets called and she refuses to appear. Esther doesn't get called and she shows up, right? So that's sort of one like interesting contrast. Vashti is silent, right? We hear that she refused, but we don't hear her say anything. Esther ends up succeeding just through her brilliant speech, right? She ultimately is able to save the Jewish people because she's very brilliant in her plan, and she's able to position and use their sort of personalities against each other with Haman and Achashverosh. But ultimately, Esther succeeds because she's very careful in how she speaks, and she makes sure to play to the king's weaknesses and use her speech in that way. Vashti is sort of like obstinate. She refuses to come, right? That's sort of what you get from the word Vayema, and she refused. It doesn't sound like it was so like, no, thank you, right? It sounds like it was a little more intense than that. And Esther, she comes to the king. We talked about this word, the trepidation and the meekness, right? Like, if it's good for you, could you please join me, right? She's so careful in how she speaks to him. She makes him feel so powerful, and she's sort of learning from her. And we see there's just major differences, not just in their tone, but also in their tactics, right? Esther's so careful. She's so thought out in her plan. She has an exact plan. It's actually interesting. I gave the Bat Mitzvah class a couple weeks ago, and we were talking about Esther, and we were talking about confidence. One of the moms said to me afterwards, like, maybe the reason Esther did two parties wasn't because that was her plan, but she chickened out the first night and she needed to like get the courage up to like have them come back again, because something just didn't feel like it was the right time to like break the news. So she needed to give it another shot. I mean, we'll never know, because it doesn't say that she planned this in advance. We don't know. But it was a very interesting perspective, because we were speaking about the idea of sort of confidence in yourself and knowing that you can do something even if it feels scary, from the and how Esther grew up throughout the story of the Megillah. And we were relating it to 12-year-old girls and their confidence and stuff. And this mom made that point. I thought that was so fascinating. Like, we don't know what was going through Esther's head. Like, she must have been shaking in her boots the entire time. Like, if this doesn't go well, what's going to happen, right? And she still does it, but she, maybe there was some sense of her that first night she just was like, something's not right here. It's not going to go well. He's not in the right mood. Let's try again tomorrow. We'll never know. But there's this Vashti who's very, like, and also think about Vashti's struggle, right? Vashti has this personal struggle with the king, and that leads to national implications. Esther has a national struggle that has personal implications, right? What does Mordechai accuse her of? You think you can just stay in the palace and hide? And maybe she could have, right? The whole Jewish people could have been destroyed, and she still would have been the anonymous Queen Esther, and nobody would have killed her. Nobody would have ever figured it out. She couldn't have lived with herself, but she could have done it potentially, right? But she decides to take this national issue and make it personal and put herself at risk for the sake of the nation. Whereas Vashti, it's all about herself, but ultimately ends up having national consequences with this edict about the women listening to their husbands. And we just sort of see how there's this vulnerability that Vashti has that is there to teach Esther. And Esther ultimately learns from Vashti's story what she needs to do in order to be successful in her situation. And maybe that's why we needed to hear from her. But I think ultimately why do we have Vashti is because her story is giving us a greater appreciation for the salvation in general that happens in the story. We see Mordechai and we see what could have been. We see how if he would have just given in, everything maybe would have been fine. But he stands up for his principles despite knowing what happened when Vashti stood up for hers. And we see how Esther learns from Vashti that if she wants to be successful, she needs to use a more diplomatic approach. Just kicking and screaming isn't going to get her anywhere. And so this whole story of Vashti, and it's only like 4 psukim, where we see Vashti in the very beginning of the story, actually lends us, first of all, to this whole discussion of like the role of Bavel and the role of Persia and all of that stuff. But also we see that even within Chazal, there's two ways of looking at Vashti. And even within the Mefarshim, there's two ways of looking at Vashti. You don't have to say she's evil. You don't have to say she's like this amazing champion of feminist values. She could be a little bit of both. We aren't ever really going to be able to know. But either way, her story is there, not just for us to understand her, but so that we can understand the story in a better way and understand Esther and Mordechai and what motivated them and what they sort of got from it. So I know I didn't give anyone any answers because I don't have an answer whether she was a victim or a villain. She might have been a little bit of both. And that's kind of what I love. I think this is my husband and I always debate this. Like, I love learning Tanakh because, like, you can read all the Mefarshim and have all these different opinions and you don't need a right answer. When you learn Halacha, like at the end of the day, well, okay, so what's the answer? What do we do, right? But with this, it's like you can be like, oh yeah, you know, like maybe it was this way, maybe it was that way. We don't know. And it's there. We can learn this lesson from this way and we can learn this lesson from that way. And in some ways, it leaves you a little unsettled. Like, well, what really happened? What was really going on there? But in the other way, it's left there ambiguously on purpose so that we can learn whatever lessons we need to learn from it depending on the situation. So I hope everybody has a wonderful Purim. And when you're sitting in shul, pay extra good attention to Perek Aleph now that we've examined it more.